Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 1165 of the Juice Box Podcast. We're calling today's guest David. He has type 1 diabetes. He also has a child with type 1 diabetes. And David is an emergency medical technician. So we're going to talk about the things he sees as an EMT. Please don't forget that nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan or becoming bold with insulin. U.S. residents who are type 1 or have a child with type 1 can help the T1D Exchange by completing a short survey. T1DExchange.org/juicebox. You can help type 1 diabetes research by completing that survey at T1DExchange.org/juicebox. When you place your first order for AG1 with my link, you'll get 5 free travel packs and a free year's supply of vitamin D. DrinkAG1.com/juicebox. Don't forget to save 40% off of your entire order at CozyEarth.com. All you have to do is use the offer code JUICEBOX at checkout. That's JUICEBOX at checkout to save 40% at CozyEarth.com. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Touched by Type 1. TouchedByType1.org. And find them on Facebook and Instagram. Touched by Type 1 is an organization dedicated to helping people living with type 1 diabetes. And they have so many different programs that are doing just that. Check them out at touchedbytype1.org. Today's episode is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes, a company that's bringing together people who are redefining what it means to live with diabetes. Later in this episode, I'll be speaking with Mark. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 28. He's 47 now. He's going to tell you a little bit about his story. And then at the very end of the episode, you can hear my entire mini interview with Mark. To hear more stories from the Medtronic Champion community or to share your own story, visit MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox and check out the Medtronic Champion hashtag on social media. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. Eversense is going to let you break away from some of the CGM norms you may be accustomed to. No more weekly or bi-weekly hassles of sensor changes. Never again will you be able to accidentally bump your sensor off. You won't have to carry around CGM supplies. And worrying about your adhesive lasting? Well, that's a thing of the past. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox.
Hi, so I'm David, and I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 16. Mm-hmm. When I was diagnosed, I was actually in the UK. So I'm 38 now, and that was when I was 16. So we're looking at 22 years ago. No family history at that time of type 1 at all. And, you know, since then, I have actually a brother-in-law on either side of the family, like one on my side and one on my wife's side of the family, who's married into the family and gotten type 1. But nobody at the time when I was diagnosed, but they're not blood relatives. You know, they're married into the family. They were not blood relatives at the time.
Sure.
And since then, one of my nephews was actually diagnosed. He was about 14 when he was diagnosed. And my son, which we'll talk about later, was also diagnosed recently.
Okay. I was going to say the next generation is going to get hit.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. David, how much of your cultural background are we going to talk about?
So I'm from the religious Jewish community. Mm-hmm. You can talk about as much as you want to talk about it or as little as you want to talk about it.
I just wondered if this was a common thing throughout your community, the autoimmune.
So there definitely is certain things that run throughout the community. I'm going to be honest, it might upset some people. I don't think our eating habits are the healthiest. You know, you've been to that weekend and you're going to be going again. You see how Jews eat on the weekend, and it's not like one Thanksgiving dinner a year or something. You know, that's like 3 times every weekend. Mm-hmm. You know, and during the week at every party, we're very big into community, so there's always events and parties. And I cannot say that the eating is the healthiest. Definitely a lot of type 2 diabetes that's prevalent within the Jewish community. Even, you know, I have friends, people that are 45 that already have type 2. Mm-hmm. or they've been told they're pre-diabetes. So there's definitely a huge type 2 factor. Type 1, again, to blame it on those types of things wouldn't be fair, so I'm not going to say it. I don't know, you know, just from being around, and I've been around for 38 years, there's not a huge surge, you know, of type 1,
okay,
that, in my opinion and from my experience.
I have a question about the food, but I want to, I made you switch to a corded headset, but the cord might be touching your clothing, so if you could be careful about that.
Oh, no worries, sorry.
No, be sorry. So this is maybe a loaded question. Do you guys eat that food on the weekends because you like it or because it's what you do?
So, good question. There's a few answers. Answer number one is it's good food. We don't eat it because we're forced to and we hate it. It's definitely good. It has cultural history. You know, it comes, a lot of it is like Eastern European, and a lot of it was made at the time because that's what they had available. You know, so oil and some potatoes, you can make something beautiful. Obviously, it's loaded in oil, but that, you know, that fed a family, didn't need meat. We're not actually so into meat. That's more of a recent thing, a modern thing, that the Jewish community got into these meat boards and things like that.
Okay.
Much more into like the carbs, potatoes, stew, that type of. So a lot of that is culturally. There's no, and it turns out it's good. I mean, you know, oil and potatoes for most people, it's like a good, warming, comforting type of food.
Yeah, I understand. I was just wondering because it's so different than what I eat. That when it was presented to me, I was like, I'm gonna go get a sandwich when you guys aren't looking.
One of my highlights was hearing you on the podcast describe that food. It was great. That was,
I really did sneak out to a deli on Saturday afternoon. I was like, I'll be back. Great experience. Okay, so you're on the show today because of something you experienced in your professional life. Is that right? What were you doing?
Yeah, so I have volunteered on an ambulance for the last 10 years. And to talk about how I got into that, actually, and then we can go back, you know, which it's all connected.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually one night I was out with my wife and we were at this location. It was late at night. It was like 11 p.m. And some lady came running inside, you know, screaming for an ambulance. Her husband had passed out screaming. There was a bunch of foreigners there. Nobody had the right, you know, I called and I didn't know. The guy could have been dead. I wouldn't have known the difference. I didn't know if he was dead, alive, breathing, not breathing.
Yeah.
You know, he's out there and he's alcohol on the floor. I'm calling the ambulance and they're not there 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 50. I call them back. I must have called them about six times and they started getting impatient with me how many times I'm calling. I didn't understand how it works. You know, they have to dispatch someone and someone has to be close by. Eventually they show up, you know, the paramedics came about 20 minutes later.
Yeah.
Turns out that this guy actually had diabetes and his sugars were extremely, extremely low to the degree that he'd gone unresponsive. You know, they gave him an IV of whatever they gave him and some juice. And he, after that, he was fine and he was on his way. But it really bothered me, the fact that I didn't know anything. And like, I could have, I mean, how stupid of me not to think even to check his sugars. You know, in hindsight, that should have been one of the first things I checked, but I didn't.
David, I have to say, I don't know about that. I don't know why you would transpose your medical condition onto somebody else's in an emergency situation. You know what I mean?
True. I guess now as a medical professional, that would have been one of the first things I would have thought of, especially as someone with type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Then I didn't. I didn't connect it, but it gave me a strong feeling of, I need to know what to do. God forbid if a situation like this happens again, I need to know what to do. I'm not the type of guy to stand by idle and watch a burning building. You know, I'm the type of guy to jump in there and help out.
Right.
So right after that, I signed up for an EMT course. You know, it took about 6 months. And ever since then, I've been volunteering in emergency medicine for 10 years. And, you know, we get to see all sorts of things from delivered multiple babies to mid-flight emergencies. And obviously a lot of diabetes and associated emergencies and illnesses that happen with it.
Right.
So I do have an inside view of the medical world and I interact with doctors, nurses, hospitals, you know, the gamut.
Yeah.
In a professional manner and obviously on a personal manner.
Well, it's wonderful you donate your time like that. That's really something that you were moved and you actually did something about it and have stuck with it for a decade is really inspiring. But it's my pleasure. I volunteered for 3 years as a fireman when I was a kid, 16 to 19, and I did it because my father had done it. I think that's why I started, and I just kind of grown up around it. And it's very rewarding. It's a lot of work, too. The training and the time and the time away from your family, all that stuff is very serious. So,
yeah, I mean, we have to go for monthly trainings in addition to obviously the time we spend on calls. And legally, you know, we have to keep up with the state requirements and there's tests. And every month we've got to do an evening of training and there's practical skills and learning skills and online. So, yeah, it's a lot of time, but it's very rewarding being able to help somebody in their time of need.
It certainly is. How many times have you thought, it's time to change my CGM? I just changed it. And then you look and realize, my God, it's been 14 days already? A week? Week and a half? Feels like I just did this. Well, you'll never feel like that with the Eversense CGM. Because Eversense is the only long-term CGM with 6 months of real-time glucose readings, giving you more convenience, confidence, and flexibility. So if you're one of those people who has that thought that, I just did this, didn't I? Why do I have to do this again right now? If you don't like that feeling, give Eversense a try. Because with Eversense, you'll replace the sensor just once every 6 months via a simple in-office visit. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox to learn more and get started today. Would you like to take a break to take a shower? You can with Eversense without wasting a sensor. Don't want anybody to know for your big day? Take it off. No one has to know. Have your sensors been failing before 10 or 14 days? That won't happen with Eversense. Have you ever had a sensor get torn off while you're pulling off your shirt? That won't happen with Eversense. So no sensor to get knocked off. It's as discreet as you want it to be. It's incredibly accurate. And you only have to change it once every 6 months. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. Right now, we're going to hear from a member of the Medtronic Champion community. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes. And this is Mark.
I used injections for about 6 months, and then my endocrinologist in the Navy recommended a pump.
How long had you been in the Navy?
8 years up to that point.
I've interviewed a number of people who have been diagnosed during service, and most of the time they're discharged. What happened to you?
I was medically discharged. Yeah, 6 months after my diagnosis.
Was it your goal to stay in the Navy for your whole life, your career?
It was, yeah, yeah. In fact, I think a few months before my diagnosis, my wife and I had that discussion about, you know, staying in for the long term. And, you know, we'd made the decision, despite all the hardships and time away from home, that was what we loved the most.
Was the Navy a lifetime goal of yours?
Lifetime goal. I mean, as my earliest childhood memories were flying, being a fighter pilot.
How did your diagnosis impact your lifelong dream?
It was devastating. Everything I had done in life, everything I'd worked up to that point was just taken away in an instant. I was not prepared for that at all.
What does your support system look like?
Friends, your family, caregivers, you know, for me, the Medtronic Champions community, you know, all those resources that are out there help guide the way, but then help keep abreast on, you know, the new things that are coming down the pipe and to give you hope for eventually that we can find a cure.
Stick around at the end of this episode to hear my entire conversation with Mark. And you can hear more stories from Medtronic Champions and share your own story at MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox. What have you seen over the years that made you reach out about this specific series, about being on this Cold Wind series?
Let me go back to my diagnosis, because I think I already started seeing things then, even though that was 22 years ago, I already started seeing things then. And I'm still seeing the same things now. So let me just go a bit back to that story and give you, you know, there's definitely been some improvements. So I was 16. I was peeing, like, you know, by the bucket, tons of weight. Everyone was telling me, I remember I went to a family wedding. Everyone was telling me how good I looked in my suit, fit me so perfectly. I had no idea. I wasn't trying to lose weight. I just, you know, lost weight as happens. I had unbearable thirst. I was drinking like insane. Now, I happened to be in the school I was in at the time. They had a vending machine right near one of the study halls. And so the Fanta was my favorite drink at the time. So there I was, thirsty as anything. Just, I was going through probably 8 bottles of Fanta a day. Now, in hindsight, I know what that was doing to me, but at the time,
sure,
you know, I had no idea. This whole process wasn't stopping, so I decided, you know, it's time to go to the doctor. I called my mom, and she made an appointment a couple of days later. as I'm actually sitting in the doctor's waiting room, there's a sign on the wall, like one of these ads. I don't even know what company it was or whatever it was. It just said, peeing a lot and thirsty and peeing a lot, you may have type 1 diabetes. So on the spot, I diagnosed myself. Yeah. I said, oh, I know exactly what I have. So I walked into the doctor's office, you know, when they called us, and I said, I have type 1 diabetes. It's like, how do you know? I said, well, I'm drinking and I'm peeing, and the sign out there says that I have it. Now, at the time, they didn't even have a glucose meter in the doctor's office. So he said, okay, let me do some blood work. I mean, he checked out some other things. I don't even remember what. He said, let me do some blood work. That was it. We left. Nothing happened from there. We went home. It was in the middle of the summer. I was a junior counselor in a camp at the time. 2 days later, I get a call from the camp office. You know, we were out in the whatever activity we were doing, that I need to come immediately to the camp office. My mother's on the way to pick me up. So she comes and she says, we just got a call from the doctor's office. The blood work came back. I don't even remember what number I was. It was at some crazy number. We're heading straight to the hospital. So I was like, okay, no problem. Straight to the hospital. So I was there for 3-4 days. And that's where I already started seeing. I mean, the fact that the doctor didn't have a blood glucose meter is ridiculous. I hope that's changed nowadays. I get to the hospital and they put me on a drip right away. They told me I have type 1 diabetes to confirm with the blood work. They put me on a drip, you know, insulin and sugar to balance things out for the first few days.
Yeah.
And then they started teaching me. They said, you know, I have to know how to use the shots to be able to go home. So I started practicing by meals, taking insulin. And I remember like the first day I'm taking the shots, it's about, you know, I don't know, let's say it's 5 p.m. The nurse comes with the insulin and she says, you need to take 5 units. I said, this is the quick acting. I said, where's the meal? She's like, the meal's coming soon. I'm like, now, keep in mind, I've been diagnosed like 3 days at this point. I know nothing.
Right.
And she's like, no, just bolus now. The meal's coming soon. I'm like, no. That doesn't how it works. They told me it's fast acting. I'm not bolusing unless I have the food in front of me because I don't know what's going to happen. Back and forth this whole along. When she goes to check, she's like, listen, this is what the chart says. The chart says 5 p.m. I'm like, dude, I'm not bolusing. I don't care. Now, I'm a 16-year-old kid, and I didn't know anything, but it just didn't sound right to me. Uh-huh. Turns out, well, I'm like, I'm not doing it. And she, you know, you're not exactly going to hold me down and inject me. Right. So I didn't take it. Well, the meal didn't actually come till 90 minutes later. Now, that would have been obviously a disaster, right, you know, bolusing, 5 units, newly diagnosed. I don't remember exactly what my ratios were then, but I'm assuming they were very, you know, very low. That would have been an absolute disaster. So already then, I was already arguing with medical staff, which is not good. It's not never good to be in an argument with them. But, you know, just because the medical and the authority and they're a nurse in a hospital, it doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't mean they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And that was that. And then basically that night, I went home with just about the same amount of info. I knew nothing. So my first few years was pretty much just nothing going on, like no information, nothing, just basal bolus, MDI, no idea. I didn't even know the concept of a carb ratio because they never told me. They just said by meals. I didn't know which foods did have carbs, didn't. I started guessing. And this goes on for the first few years. And then one day, and the doctor's visits were a complete waste of time. You know, you go into the doctor and they're like, oh, well, why don't you just eat better and exercise? I'm like, what? I didn't like.
Like, I have type 1 diabetes. Do you know the difference between the two of them? Also, let me ask you, David, that interaction in that hospital at that first moment, it's funny because the nurse was right and wrong. Like, it would have been great for you to inject a little sooner before the food came, but not 90 minutes sooner, obviously. But then did that scare you off or make you very specific about injecting and eating right away?
So I was always a little scared of insulin. Mm-hmm. As a general rule, and I actually told this to my son, who's actually very into pre-bolusing now, but, you know, especially in school and things, where if you have an unknown, you know, let's say if you're in school in your regular schedule and it's lunch every day at 2 o'clock and that doesn't change the whole year, no problem, bolus while you're in class 15 minutes before. But if you're in camp and it's a topsy-turvy schedule and you don't know what's going on and you don't know if lunch is going to be at 2:30, 2:45, don't bolus till at least you see some food trays and you know that it's actually lunch coming
starting
out.
Starting to happen. Yeah, yeah.
So I wouldn't say I was scared, but I immediately got the feeling that I was on my own, meaning I couldn't trust what I was being told by the medical staff around me. Mm-hmm. And that pretty much didn't change when I got you know, to my appointments, it was like these silly appointments. They didn't really give me any tools to tell me anything. It was just like, okay, let's do some blood work. Let's whatever. And that pretty much went on for a few years. And then, and keep in mind, I didn't have a Dexcom at this time or a pump, anything. I always was into checking my sugars a lot. You know, I had this argument with, the only other person I knew at the time who had type 1 diabetes, I had a classmate who had it since he was like 4. And I have memories of like being in his house and he had to pee on a stick to go get his sugars.
Yeah.
That was the only thing I knew about it at the time. And that's it. So I just had this feeling that I was on my own and got to figure things out myself. And then it was a few years later, the hospital started offering this thing that was called a DAFNI course. They called it a dose adjustment for normal eating. And it was like a trial pilot program.
David, were you in the UK then?
This is the UK.
I was going to say, I've heard of DAFNI before, but I thought it was still UK. Okay. All right.
Sorry. So I'm still in the UK at the time. Yeah. This was like the pilot of DAFNI. I was one of the first participants in the DAFNI course.
No kidding.
And they offered it to me. I actually changed hospitals because I realized also the hospital I was seeing were really useless, which is another thing. I see people stuck with the same hospital, same doctor for years. Like, if you're not happy, find somebody else who's better. So I changed to this other hospital that was offering, and then they offered me this DAFNI course. I went, there was a group of, I think we were 8 or 10, and they taught us the basics. Like, when I say basics, I'm talking about what basal insulin does, what bolus insulin does, what carbs are, carb ratio, just literally the basics. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it was mind-blowing. I was like, oh my gosh, there's a science to this. This actually makes sense. And I got really into it. Now, even though I didn't have a Dexcom, I was checking my sugars probably 10, 14 times a day. And I made my own graph. Like, I wrote down literally on a spreadsheet what it was in the morning, 2 hours later, 4 hours later, 6 hours later. And together with that and MDI, I managed to regulate myself together with that knowledge that I had gotten then.
Wow.
And I got very, very good on MDI to a point that, you know, I had it down to a science. But I also got ticked off because I realized like they were sitting on this information for years. Like, what were they expecting me to without this information? And then I got upset at myself as well. I'm like, I could have just Googled this 5 years ago and found out this information. I don't know if your podcast was around then, but I'm sure I could have found something
right. That,
you know, this that had the basics. So I really realized at that point that there's nobody going to take care of you. You know, you got to be your own doctor and you got to get on top of it yourself. Nobody's going to do it for you. You'll go to every appointment and they'll just make a comment like, why don't you eat healthy and exercise? Or why don't you just this? And why don't you this, that? Or they'll give you an adjustment and they're not going to see you again for another 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the,
mindset that I have to take care of myself. And
I realized then, I was about 19, 20 at that time. And I realized like, there's nobody going to take care of me. Nobody. You know, obviously my parents were willing to help if I needed help with anything. But at that point, I was pretty independent. I actually didn't want my parents involved. I never let them get involved from day one. I'm just more of a private person. There was nobody going to help me. Nobody was going to work out my carb ratios. Nobody was going to tell me how to adjust basals and test and you know, all these things. I realized then that I really got to get into it myself and take my own responsibility. And that, my opinion hasn't changed. It's only gotten stronger over the years being in the medical field.
Yeah. Did you rely on your parents for other things? Was it specific to diabetes that you wanted to be on your own, or was that kind of your...
Yeah, so I relied on them for everything else. I mean, I was living at home, I was eating at home, I was, you know, sleeping at home, and they paid for everything. They paid for my tuition, they paid for any extracurricular activities I was doing, they were pretty much doing everything. But specifically with this, I don't know what it is. I'm like, you know what, I guess it's like a personal thing on your own body. It's like weird, somebody else being involved. Definitely at that time, that's how I felt. I'm not going to say I changed drastically since then. Yeah, I did not let them get involved.
How involved is your wife with your care, if at all?
Oh, so that's a great question. So it's changed actually since my son was diagnosed. So I would say in the first years of our marriage, which was the first 11 years before our son was diagnosed, she wasn't involved in anything. She didn't follow my share. I didn't tell her anything about it, high, low, because I'm also the opinion that don't use diabetes as an excuse. You got to live your everyday to the fullest, mm-hmm. family time, whatever it is. Like, there's no like excuses. Oh, I'm low now, I can't do this. I'm high now, I can't do that. So I almost consciously didn't get her involved because I'm not like, oh, now I'm high, now I'm low, now I'm this, now I'm that. I can't do this, I can't do that. Like, it was a family trip. it's a family trip. Doesn't matter what I am. I got to work it out around that.
Yeah.
And she didn't know much because of that. She was very good at doing anything that she knew would help me. So like she knew like certain types of food that I stay away from, or I have preferences for certain food. She would cook any, you know, family meals appropriately, always making sure I had. She wasn't not involved because she didn't care. She wasn't involved because I didn't let her get involved not in a bad way. I just didn't get her involved. Now that changed a little bit since her son was diagnosed. And I have to say, even though I'm the one with type one, she's taken on most of the brunt of it. You know, she's the one that wakes up at night. I go to sleep. You can hear a bomb. I won't hear a thing. So like if he goes low in the middle of the night, she's the one that gets up. She's the one that deals with it. And also during the day a lot. At work, I can't deal with things. You know, he's got questions. He's texting or whatever. She's on top of the game with it.
Right.
And then since then, I realized, like, it's also stupid. Like, it's actually scary. I've never had a low that I needed somebody else's assistance. But I realized after that, I should probably have somebody following me. God forbid if something did happen. So since then, I've added her to my follow, but nothing much else. But now she understands it. She's an avid listener of your podcast now. and she understands a lot more from you than she got from me, you know, in the last 2 years.
I asked a little because it's okay that I talk about the event last year. Is that all right
for you? Yeah. Go ahead.
So I know we're keeping you anonymous, but there's no way that people who don't know you wouldn't know this was you by your story, though, right? You're just worried about the larger audience not being able to figure out who you are. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I don't know if I talked about this in the podcast or not, but I did a spouse talk, and I scared the holy hell out of everybody, and I did not mean to. Like, I was just going over what I just thought were, like, some, you know, obvious things to say about, like, glucagon, and I could see, like, there's horror on a lot of the wives' faces. And I was like, you know, everybody should know how to use glucagon. And maybe once the kids were older, we would tell them like when we would call 911 if like mom or dad, like, you know, couldn't do it themselves. And I saw the looks on their face. They were like, couldn't do what themselves? Why wouldn't they be able to do that? Then I looked, and I'm not sure how many people have ever been in this situation, but I was in a room where, you know, the women and the children were on one side, the men were on the other, and it's a divided room. So you guys can't see each other. So I see the horror on the wives' faces. And then I look to the men, and a lot of them are looking at me like, hey, buddy, what are you telling them that for? and I thought, oh, gosh, did they not talk about this?
It's not for religious reasons.
No, I didn't think so, by the way.
Yeah. It's not. And you did the right thing. And it is the right thing. And I myself changed my – I actually was not by the event, but I heard feedback from it and changed my attitude as a result. That actually from that – your talk at that event, that's when my wife's – even though I didn't hear the talk, I heard feedback from friends and other people were there. And I changed my opinion on it.
I'm glad because I was – I'll tell you what, for a minute, I felt like I was I wasn't getting out of the room alive. And then everybody was really kind about it. Actually, I spoke to the rabbi's wife later in the afternoon, and I said, I'm so sorry. I never would have imagined. And she said, no, you did the right thing. She goes, some people are upset, but I think they're just upset with this new knowledge they have, not necessarily with you for bringing it. And it was fine, actually. But it's nice to hear that was valuable for people.
Yeah, very, very valuable.
Okay. All right, so when you're out on that rig and you're interacting with, imagining a lot of emergency rooms, what would we be shocked by to learn about medical staff in a hospital?
So you'd be shocked by, unfortunately, I'm not shocked by it anymore. Mm. And I don't want to put a bad name on medical staff.
No.
There's very good people out there, and these people are dedicating their lives to helping other people.
Of course.
But the knowledge and sometimes the stupidity is at a whole new level that sometimes it's just like, now you have good people out there. And I don't think you have bad actors. You know, I don't want to say it in that way. People are intentionally, but just because they have a medical badge and a medical title doesn't mean they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I saw this 22 years ago when I was diagnosed and the nurse is trying to force me to take a shot when the food is coming 90 minutes later. Mm-hmm. And I see this now, you know, and I see the other side as well. I see patients that just don't take care of themselves. And you know, I've seen patients over the years who would go one time and the sugars are 200 and 250. I'm like, did you take your insulin? They're like, no. I'm like, well, what are you waiting for? And then a few years later, you know, you come back one day and the leg is amputated. And they just, you know, they have the attitude that somebody in the medical field is going to take care of them. they're not going to take care of themselves. And that's not true. It's never going to happen. And sometimes the adherence to protocol, you know, I'll give you an example. We got a call one night, this kid, he calls. We don't always get a lot of information when the calls come over, but it came through as something with, you know, diabetes related. We came there and his Dexcom had done this weird thing. It had shown like he was high and now had gone back to, you know, I'm not going to call it range, but relatively it wasn't showing high anymore. It was showing like 200s, 200 to 300 range. And so we did a finger stick, which by the way, even that, it's only a recent thing that we're allowed to do finger sticks.
I know. Yeah, I've heard that recently. Okay.
Which is shocking. Anyway, we do a finger stick and I don't remember what it was. It was 250 or 300. But his doctor, they had been in touch with the doctor and the doctor said, they got to go to the emergency room. I'm like, what the hell? This doctor obviously doesn't have diabetes. Why does he need to go to the emergency room? His sugars are 300. Take a bit of insulin, see what happens. The doctor's like, no, no, no. Now, we can't argue with doctors because of the level of hierarchy and authority. An ambulance is lower than a doctor. Like if a doctor gives orders for somebody to go to the hospital, we cannot argue with those orders. If we were to leave a patient home, we would need a doctor's permission to leave the patient home, especially a minor. So, you know, we took that kid to the emergency room, even though in my heart, I'm like, this kid doesn't need an emergency room. He needs a bit of knowledge. The mother needs to know how to bolus a little better.
Right.
And, but on the flip side, afterwards, I'm like, you know what? I sort of blame them because why do you even call the doctor? I mean, I have not called a doctor in 22 years. I'm not here to show up because I don't think they're going to, what exactly are they going to tell you? If you call a doctor, these people, every 2 minutes that they're on the phone with the doctor's office, you know, I added this. How do I bolus this? I added that. Should I split it? Should I bolus it? Should I extend it? If your care plan is to rely on your doctor's office, you got to get a new care plan. That's not a good plan. Just think, you know, your doctor went to medical school 10, 15 years ago. And when they were in medical school, they learned knowledge that was probably at the time 10, 15 years old. Half of them have information that's just ancient. And you're calling them in 2024 when you got pumps, algorithms, and all sorts of things that the better ones keep up with it. You know, they sort of get an update from their local reps as to new features and things like that.
Yes.
But they're giving you information from 2005 and you're calling them how to bolus. I mean, that's not a good care plan.
Yeah.
You've got to get a better care plan than that, which is really understanding it yourself. Listen to the pro tips. Just understand it yourself and get a handle of it. Otherwise, you're going to spend your life calling doctors and being whipped off to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm. And it happens more than we think, right? Like more than even I believe, type ones that end up at the hospital for some sort of care.
Happens the whole time. I mean, we have a patient. There's actually two patients in the same area. That there was a point they were calling every day. One day it's like, can you check my sugars? I'm like, you don't have a machine? Oh, yeah, yeah, but whatever. I just called the ambulance to check my sugars. And then the next one, like, was calling every time he needed an injection. He was calling us, you know, so every night it was like almost the same time consistently, 11 p.m. And then you're at the doctor's room. The doctor just says, the doctor between me and you, for the most part, are just worried about a lawsuit. That's in the way they think. So the way they think about it is if they give directions for this patient to stay home and then something happens during the night, they got a big problem on their hands.
That person's going to say that doctor told me to do this and it put me in this
correct.
Situation.
So the doctor's much better saying, you know what, put him in an ambulance, take him to an emergency room. And then the emergency room does all their due diligence. They normally just throw them on the side somewhere for 6-8 hours, give them a bit of insulin, don't give them a bit of insulin. But that way everyone's covered. They call it CYA in the medical field.
I think they call it CYA everywhere, but yeah.
But it's well used in the medical field. And I think there's a big difference then, you know, knowing when you're dealing with a patient, are you actually dealing with medical information or are you CYA? And it really depends with the patient, which is why, you know, you can't always know. Some people, you can give them a piece of information and say, you know what, instead of calling the ambulance, why don't you just bolus and see what happens in 2 hours? Some people wouldn't know what to do with that information. They have no idea. They'd bolus and then they call you back in 2 hours because they don't know now what. Now I'm dropping. Meanwhile, they're like 196 double down. I'm like, 196 double down is great. That's exactly where you want to be. Mm-hmm. Call me back when you're 60 double down and you've taken juice and it's not working. That's a different story.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this, you know, we see this the whole time.
Now, I want to go back to something you said at the very beginning, because I've now made a number of these episodes, and I want to make sure people understand I'm not saying not to go to the hospital if you have an emergency. I'm not saying that there aren't wonderful nurses and doctors and even hospitals and, you know, any number of healthcare professionals. I'm just saying that when you can't be sure that every time you flip the coin, it's going to land on heads, you have to know that sometimes it might land on tails and what to do. If you're running to a doctor for an answer, to kind of echo your thought, and the doctor's only going to do CYA, that's not going to put you on a good path, and you're going to cycle over and over again. Then this is your life then. This becomes your entire existence. I don't really know what I'm doing. Nobody's telling me what to do. I wouldn't think to go look for this information because I am talking to a doctor and they're telling me what to do. If the right thing to do, you know, the thing the doctor told me, puts me in the hospital every couple of months, well, that just must be diabetes. And so they don't believe there's something better for them. And then they run back to the physician or the ER thinking, well, these are the magic people. They'll put me right back again. And you're telling me that those people are thinking, let's just shelf this person for a few hours, get them stable and get them the hell out of here.
Exactly. Oh, and you'd be shocked. I mean, you wouldn't be because you hear this, you know, more than me, how long people live their whole life like this. Like, this is their life.
Yeah.
It's the difference between not dying and living. I think those are the two extremes, meaning you might not die yet, but that's not a life. I know how I felt when I was, you know, out of control. You're not the way you feel. Like, I don't, you know, my last A1C, I just actually got it done last week, was 6.2.
Oh, good. Good job.
That doesn't really motivate me, between me and you.
The number.
Yeah. What motivates me is how I feel every single day.
Yeah.
If I'm high, I'm not living a day. I'm not a father. I'm not a husband. I get very pissed off and stressed when I'm high. I already feel when I'm high over, you know, 140, 160, I already feel, start getting frustrated. If I'm 250, you don't want to talk to me. That motivates me much more than an A1C that I see every 6 months or something. I could leave it. I could be 250 every day and probably wouldn't die, or just not yet. But that's not living. To me, that's not living.
Yeah.
And I think that's also the big difference between the different attitudes that people take between are they just, you know, going to the doctor and doing what they need to do. And I did that. I was in that process for years until I took care of myself and realized that no doctor, like, the doctor is just going to keep doing. And when it comes to the time, like, okay, now it's time for an amputation. You know, today's there's no difference to the doctor. Like, today's I don't want to sound like I'm putting them down, but in their field, today they're putting someone on the pump and today they're amputating the other person's leg because they didn't take care of themselves for 30 years. They're not going to take responsibility for that person. And if the person doesn't take responsibility himself. So I think that's also the big difference. You got to decide, you know, how you want to live your life. If you want to just not die, or you actually want to be living and feeling normal on a daily basis.
Yeah, David, I think I stopped saying don't die advice on the podcast because I even thought it sounded harsh. But I used to say it a lot. Like, usually the advice you get from a doctor is don't die advice. It's enough to keep you from dying, not enough to help you live well.
Correct.
I think I brought it up at the talk, and I every time I speak somewhere, I say, you know, you deserve to be who you would be without fluctuating blood sugars. And like you just said, like, you don't want to be around me when my blood sugar is over 250. The other thing is that in the middle of that turmoil, you don't really know that about yourself. I don't know if that's something that people can really wrap their heads around. Like, you're altered and you're acting a way that you would not normally. And that if you could see yourself out of body, you'd be disappointed with. And yet you don't know it's happening while it's happening. And now you're impacting all the relationships in your life. And like you said, who knows what else? Like, if you're watching a television show with a 250 blood sugar, you may not enjoy it the same way as you would with a 95 blood sugar. And that might sound trivial, but I don't think it is. I think you're experiencing the world differently. And then in turn, the world gets a different version of you, one that I don't think you really want to be out there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I've experienced this myself. And, you know, I didn't really talk about my son yet, but he went through various stages. There was a stage, actually, unfortunately, started in summer camp where he didn't give up, but it was very tough. It was his first time going, first of all, it was his first time going away from home at all. Mm-hmm. And then definitely with type 1 diabetes and dealing with all different foods. And his sugars just started getting into the 300-400s every single day. And he sort of gave up. He was still bolusing. That's why I don't want to use the word gave up. But he was not, I would say, more like he was more careless. And this went on for a few months. And he was just, you know, you don't even realize it as a parent because you see them every day. And then, thank God, he calmed down. And there was a few things that I think it was attributed to. And I'm going to talk about him more in a minute. But once, just to go back to your previous point, once his sugars got back to a normal level, he was so pleasant. We didn't even realize. My wife was like, oh my gosh, do you realize that he's been so pleasant?
Yeah.
He's been nice to his siblings. He's been participating in family things. He's been doing amazing at school. And we didn't even realize while we're going through it. So it's almost like this subconscious effect.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't even realize till he calmed down and his sugars were at a normal level. Like, he's such a pleasure. He's helping around the house. He's offering to do things. So I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I kick myself sometimes because I think I saw my son's Hashimoto's before I let it register in my head that that's what it would be. And it was all about his behavior. When his thyroid's not well moderated, he has a short fuse.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, he's a teenager or he's upset about something. But now I look back and I think, I wonder how many of his life events did he not traverse as well as he could have if we would have known about this sooner. And I mean, I know there's not much you can do about it, and I don't dwell in it, but it makes the point that when you're altered, you're altered.
Right. And I think also parents don't realize things sometimes, you know, when you're with your kids every day, because sometimes they're gradual changes and you don't notice them as extreme as obviously somebody who, you know, so, and I'll give you, I saw an example of this, an unfortunate example of this. I had a good friend who, when he was 8, he was diagnosed with cancer. It was actually my mother that diagnosed him. What I mean by that is he came, you know, we used to have play dates the whole time, and he came over to my house and my mother said, no, he doesn't look good. And she called his mother right away. And the mother was like, no, he's fine. This is, you know, nothing. They're like, oh, they took him to the doctor. It turns out he actually had cancer, but, you know, thank God he recovered. It was a long story. It wasn't just, you know, it went on for a while. You can imagine with treatments and everything. But my point being that his own mother didn't realize that,
right?
Because, you know, sometimes you're with your kids every day, or you're with people around you every day, and you think, you know what, this is how they are. They're just more rough around the edges. But then you realize, no, they're actually, this is how they are when the sugars are 250.
100%. David, I've lost like 45 pounds this year. So actually, if we see each other soon, I'm literally 45 pounds lighter than I was when you saw me before.
Good for you.
No, thank you. But if you ask my son 2 months into the journey, when I was down the first 15 pounds, I said, hey, you know, do you notice anything? Didn't notice a damn thing. And he was living away from home. Then I saw him a couple months later and I walked in. Now I was like 25 pounds lighter. I thought, for sure he'll notice something now. Nothing really. And then when I asked him, I said, do you see that I've lost weight? He goes, yeah, I guess I can. And now a year later, if you show him a photo from last year, now he goes, oh my God, I didn't realize.
Right.
Like, he didn't know. He actually said to me one time, one of the kinder things he's ever said to me, I don't think of you as a fat person. But I looked at the picture and I was like, I don't know how you couldn't. But the same thing with the mother. Like, the mother's with a kid with cancer. Your mom sees him in 5 seconds, goes, hey, what are we doing here? You know what I mean? And the other person's like, what do you mean? And it's that slow drip transition. And I'm telling you, that can happen slowly over years with weight. It could happen slowly over months with your attitude, and it could happen day to day. If your blood sugars are bouncing around, you turn into this. I had a friend when we were growing up, and he's not with us anymore, but I knew him to be a very sweet and lovely person. But I knew some people who met him who thought he was cantankerous and unpleasant.
Right.
But he wasn't. He was on regular and MPH, and his blood sugars were high all the time, and then not. And, you know, like, and he got to live his whole life that way. People met him and thought, this kid's a dick, you know? And he really wasn't. He was lovely. And now I don't know, I look back and his life was shortened because of it. And now what did he miss out on, even, you know, in a shortened life? So I, you know, it's very important.
Yeah. So like when our son was diagnosed, so we didn't even realize till we looked back at pictures how much weight he had lost. He was stick thin, and like, we didn't even notice.
Yeah.
It was only afterwards, once he was diagnosed, and we started looking back. But seeing him on a daily basis, we didn't even, you know, we didn't notice anything.
Right. No, it's something. Okay. What else do we need to know about? I guess maybe, why don't we dig into your expertise for a second? Type 1s, call an ambulance. What should we be telling people when they arrive? You know, what's on us? You know, I know I've done an episode where I told people, we had an EMT on, I think, who said, like, you know, don't count on your diabetes tattoos. You know, you have to be wearing the jewelry. It has to
Nobody
be
looks
place.
At those, by the right. way. I hate to break the news, but now there is a difference. If you're out cold in a car crash and you're completely gone and they cut all your clothes off, yeah, then somebody's going to notice Yeah, to two. But on a regular call, don't count on that. Make sure you tell someone what's going on.
Yeah. So I call right away. Do I want to say to the dispatcher, I'm calling for someone who has type 1 diabetes. They're unconscious. They're having a seizure. Or I'm calling for myself. I think I'm going to become unconscious soon. I've taken too much insulin. I have type 1 diabetes. Do you try to tell them I'm wearing a glucose monitor? I'm wearing a, like, do you give them as much as you can?
So I would definitely go with the first part. I wouldn't get into I'm wearing a glucose monitor and I'm wearing a pump. Chances are that information is not going to convey over to the actual units they dispatch. But the more information about what's going on, for sure, because there's different level priorities and emergencies. And based on the priority that it sounds like when it comes through, they'll dispatch accordingly, which means they'll dispatch, you know, priority resources, additional resources, more advanced resources. Like in most areas, there's EMTs and there's medics. If you are out cold, unresponsive, you want medics. You don't want just EMTs. Now, by default, they only dispatch EMTs. Even, you know, so if somebody calls on the phone and says, I'm diabetic and I'm having an issue, they'll just send you two EMTs. Now, that's a big difference between saying I'm diabetic and I think I'm going into a coma. By default, you're already going to get medics in most cases. You know, it's not a guarantee, but in most cases, a good dispatcher will hear that and they'll already dispatch medics. So you definitely want to be giving, you know, the most information as you can over there and always open the door. You know, we had cases where we can't get in the front door and then there's a delay because you got to get the fire department to take the door down.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, this person's, you know, their sugars are 10, 20, or whatever they're at down there on the floor by themselves in the bedroom. So you definitely want to make sure to have a plan for that. And this also goes back to you know, what I was saying before. We've had calls. I got a call one night for, you know, it was diabetes related. It was 3 a.m. And turns out that this girl, she was fast asleep. We were bashing, knocking, pounding. Eventually, the husband heard us open up the door. Well, her sugars were low. Like the Dexcom was just reading low. She was fast asleep. Her mother was following her in a different state. But her mother was following her. This goes into what you were saying before about always making sure you have somebody following you. And she called us. And, you know, thank God we got there on time. And we woke her up. You know, the husband heard the door. We woke her up. And, you know, she took sugar and she was fine.
Yeah. I stopped a low for Arden last night that she didn't hear. At 3 a.m., my Dexcom alerted me. I woke up and I waited one revolution of the Dexcom to make sure she didn't, like, because it was a weird thing. Like, she looked like she went from 80 to like 50 real quickly. And I thought maybe she's laying on it. I'll give her a second. And then it held. So I called her and she didn't answer, but she called me right back. She goes, hey, what's up? And you could tell she'd been asleep for a while. It's funny. I was more aggressive about it last night than I might have been because I spoke to her earlier in the evening. And at dinner time, she said, oh, I'm not very hungry. So I thought, oh, she's not going to eat much tonight. And it actually stuck in my head. I'll be aware of lows tonight because her algorithm's still going to do what it always does. And she's been eating more the last couple of weeks. And so I thought, oh, the algorithm's being aggressive. And then she more recently moved her GLP up a little bit. And so now she's eating a little less, but the algorithm's still getting the vibe. So anyway, I was thinking about a low. I woke her up. I said, hey, I think you're low. And she stopped. I could hear her focus herself. And she goes, yeah, I think I am too. And I was like, okay. I'm like, are you going to drink a juice? I said, I could stay on the phone with you to make sure you drink it. She goes, no, I'll do it. And she hung up.
Right.
So then, of course, David, I lose her data almost as soon as she hangs up. So now I'm like, I swapped over to like Night Scout real quick. Night Scout thought her blood sugar was 40. And I know she drank the juice, right? I believe that she did. I spoke to her. She was clear-headed. And I waited one revolution, 5 minutes. It didn't come back. I waited another revolution, 5 minutes. It didn't come back. And I thought, okay, like, this is the moment here. Like, she either drank the juice and she's okay, or she fell back asleep and didn't drink the juice and she's in trouble. And I did this thing that I don't know if people know. Like, I sent her a text to reestablish her connection to the internet. So I don't know if you've ever seen this, but if you lose data sometimes coming from someone else, if you ping their phone, then their phone pings a tower, and then sometimes you get the data back. So I sent a text that just said, hey, I can't see your data. Are you okay? I'd never thought she was going to see that. I figured she was asleep still. And as soon as I did that, I swear to you, as soon as I did that, boom, she was 95. And wow. She had an arrow up, and I was like, oh, okay, good.
Our son, who's now 12, he It's actually a little scary. I mean, I myself, I don't hear alerts during the night. Like I said, I sleep like a log. Yeah. I don't hear nothing, but I do wake up when I feel low. So even though I never wake up from the Dexcom and I have SugarMate set to call me, I still don't hear it. My wife hears it. She wakes me up. But I, like, if I'm by myself, I don't hear it. I wake up from a low, like I'm feeling low. My son doesn't. It's actually pretty scary. We wake him up, you know, when he's low and we give him juice and he normally doesn't know a thing in the morning. And we're like, you know, you were low last night at 2 a.m. and, you know,
no remembrance. Like,
oh, yeah? Really?
Yeah.
He has no idea.
Arden was like that right until she went to college. And then it was like once she knew it was on her, she started to wake up.
Right.
Like, I don't know why she didn't last night, or maybe she would have in a couple of minutes more. I don't know. She's been very, very good about it. And she's almost on her second year of college. She's been very good about it.
I'm assuming as he gets older, it's something that he'll just, right. And like you said, once he have to take more responsibility, then it's just something that he'll, you know, he'll just get into.
Also, when she comes home for her breaks, like she announces to me coming through the door, like, hey, I'm not waking up for lows anymore. Like, this is on you. I need a
it's
break.
On you.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So we actually had that with our son. Not with that, but with, you know, there was a time. Well, he was. Let me. I never went through his full story. Let me just tell you the basics of his thing. So he was 9 and just was not feeling well. He was looking like I said, the weight we didn't notice, but he just was not feeling well. Every day he was telling me, "I'm just not doing good. I'm not doing good." And then it was one morning, he woke up and started vomiting. Hmm. And I'm like, all right, okay, something, I don't know what. Oh, I know what, actually. Not only did he vomit, he peed in his bed.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, something is off. He's 9. He wasn't doing that for years already. Something is off. He's vomiting. He doesn't look good. I said, let me check his sugars. I check, and they're like 250. Hmm. My heart went through the floor. You can't even imagine. And then I'm like, in my head, like, this is all in like 5 seconds. I'm telling you, know, maybe he just has a virus. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that, maybe it's that. You know, I went through 1400 maybes, not wanting to believe the truth. So immediately, literally still in the hallway, right after I just pulled out a Dexcom from my closet, I had a spare, it was a G6 at the time transmitter. I just stuck it on him. So he had the Dexcom running before we even got to the doctor. You know, I called the doctor. I woke up my wife. It was early in the morning. We went to the doctor. And you know, they sent us into the endo's office, and we were there. They thank God we managed to avoid the hospital. He wasn't in DKA. Right. We spent all day in the endo's office getting. Now, because I had the experience, they weren't so scared to let me home because they saw right away that I knew, you know, how to bolus and what to do. So they weren't too scared. He was extremely sensitive to insulin in the beginning. When I say like his basals were like 0.10, like an hour, 0.20, and like it was impossible on MDI. Impossible. He had such swings, like he gave him a tiny bolus and he went flying down, flying in minutes.
Right.
So I couldn't handle it. After a week, I called the endo. I didn't need their permission. But it's always better if you can be not to be in a fight with your medical team. At the end of the day, you know, it's better if you're on the same page, and it's not always possible, but if you can be, it's always better to be on the same page. So this is only a week after he's diagnosed. I had a spare tandem with Control IQ sitting in my closet. I'm like, guys, you know what's going on over here. You see what's going on. Do you mind if I just stick the pump on him? And I'm not waiting 6 months for insurance bureaucracy and whatever. And I'm watching these swings. We're not sleeping. You can imagine what every night was like. Yeah, you know what you're doing. Just stick the pump on him. So a week after he was diagnosed, he was ready on the pump. And then, you know, eventually his pump came through. I don't even remember. It didn't, you know, however many months later, you know, once insurance sorted everything out and that we. So he was like, in the beginning, he was actually scared to eat. Like he just, we realized after a few weeks that he's barely eating, and like he didn't want to get into the bolusing and the highs, the lows, and dealing with all of that. And then there was a time where he basically just said to us, like, even though we never put it on him, he did like voluntarily offer to, like, he's like, oh, I think I can change my pump myself. So I'm like, okay, sure, change your pump yourself. That's a great thing. And the same with the Dexcom. But then there was a stage where I wouldn't call it denial. I'd say he got a little fed up. Yeah. And he's like, okay, it's just on you. Like, I'm not doing this anymore. I said, no problem. We're going to change your pumps. We're going to change your Dexcoms. We're going to monitor. We're going to text you if you need to take something. It's not. I said, there should be no worry on your head. When you're ready, you'll let me know if you want to take over any more responsibility.
Right.
So I think it's definitely important that kids know that, you know, parents are willing to take whatever responsibility they can off their head.
Has he done that? How long has he had type 1?
So now he's 12. So it's about 2.5 years now.
Has he come to you and said, hey, I'd like to do a little more, or not yet?
So yes. And interestingly, you'll find it interesting what I attribute this to. He's a competitive type and he's a bit of a perfectionist. Like, I'm a perfectionist, which is not always a great thing with type 1, because, you know, like, I get frustrated. Like, if I look back, like, the last 90 days, I'm like 80% enraged. I don't like that, because I'm like 80. It should be like 98. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, he started the G7, which I happen to hate. I'll give you my opinion on that in a minute. So personally, I'm still on the G6. He started the G7. And what I found about it, interestingly, is that, you know, Clarity in the G7 is in the same app. Like, it's not a separate app. Even though, yes, he had Clarity before on his phone, he never actually would go and check it. But now your time in range and, you know, how much you're high and how much you're low, it's all right there. So yes, when you're checking your Dex app, now that's the only thing I attribute it to, because he started coming to me and saying, like, hey, look, this is how much time I'm... We never even had those conversations before. Oh. He wasn't even like... he's gotten really into this, and I hope it lasts. I mean, when I say into this, I'm talking about 7:13 a.m. this morning. He texts me and my wife a picture showing 96% time in range over the last 3 days.
He's proud of himself.
Very proud of himself. Yeah. And we didn't do a thing for this. We've never told him off. We've always let him eat whatever he wants to eat. I always just, if you want to eat, you got to bolus. I can't in my right conscience tell him he can eat without bolusing. But he got into this himself. And I think it's because of the G7 seeing, because there's nothing else I can attribute it to.
Like a video game to him almost.
Yeah. So I think that's been a game changer. And to the degree, I mean, here's, put it this way. When we came back from the summer from camp, his A1C was 8. When we went to the doctor's office 3 weeks ago, his A1C was 6.5.
Wow, look at him.
That's a wonderful, huge change.
Yeah.
And actually before, this was actually a nice thing. Before we actually went into the appointment, I went to speak to one of the CDEs. She's amazing. They have some really, really, not everyone over there is, but they have, you know, we've changed around doctors a few times till we got one that we like and the CDE. And I told her, I said, listen, he's been working really hard. Make sure you guys make a big deal out of it. So she and the doctor came in the room singing, celebrating, like, oh my God, A1C 6.5. Who is this kid? And made a whole big deal out of it. And his smile, he was brimming from cheek to cheek. So, yeah. So that was really nice. You know, that was nice to see. And it was nice that they got on board. And we didn't do anything. Like he took this on. No, he started pre-bolusing and he started, you know, just taking note of things. And so that's been, yeah, the last few months have been, he's definitely been taking on much more on himself.
I'm happy for him. That's wonderful. Because what it means is that he's in an endeavor to get that time and range better. He's bolusing. He's looking at numbers and going, I don't want to let this high blood sugar sit here. I'll knock it down a little bit.
Correct.
Yeah, has to be. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's made him more involved in his bolusing.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And he has the, we got him, we didn't have it right away. And this one piece of advice, I mean, we got him the Apple Watch. That was a game changer. I mean, before that, we were paying like $400 out of pocket a week because we couldn't get it covered through insurance for somebody to be in school with him, just to basically pass him on messages. They weren't like a CD or something. They were just like a messenger. We would text, because he doesn't want to take out his phone during class. So he can't see what was going on. Like, he can't see what his sugars are. He can't see if he's supposed to, you know, take sugar, what he's supposed to do. So we're paying $400 a week for some guy to stand there and basically just pass him my messages. And we didn't have a choice, you know.
No kidding.
So once we got him an Apple Watch, that was a game changer. I mean, he sees his text during class, you know. So if he's low, we'll text him, you know, a little bit of juice. Mm-hmm. He responds right. Also, even if he was low, we had no idea if he dealt with it, because he wasn't going to take out his phone in the middle of class and start texting.
Yeah.
Now, right away, he just sends a thumbs up. So that's also been a game changer.
I have a couple of questions before I let you go.
Go ahead.
Going back to the rescue squad, to ambulance. First of all, can a passed out type 1 look like an OD?
Yes. And they can also look like drunk. So, which is why we never had the protocol to test blood sugars. Like I said before, we weren't even allowed to test blood sugars. But because of multiple incidents in the last few years where a type 1 diabetic was passed out was taken as a drunk or taken as an OD. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, they're shooting them up with Narcan, but you know, that's the last thing they need. That's why they brought in the blood sugar protocol. And it's pretty much protocol now that anyone that passes out or is obviously unresponsive, first thing is check their blood sugar. That's definitely been a you know, a huge improvement.
Is that a nationwide thing? How do they communicate that stuff to?
So it's not. That's the silly thing. You know, as much as America is one country, it's like every state has its own rules and regulations. Okay. It's not a nationwide thing. It goes state by state.
I see.
So I don't know. I can't promise that that's in every state. But I know on the East Coast, that's definitely been a recent change in the last few years.
My last question that I'm not sure how well I'm going to articulate it, but I keep having this feeling. So let me see if I can get through it with you. Sometimes I feel like the people who listen to the podcast are either people who are taking very good care of themselves or are on their way to doing that. About the person who's struggling every day, who doesn't understand their insulin well and all the things that we've talked about. But both people are going to end up calling an ambulance at some point with diabetes, likely. Like the ones who feel like they have it together and know what they're doing, and the ones who are completely lost. What does the ambulance crew expect when they get there? Like, who are you being categorized as when someone's coming through the door? Is that, or maybe you're not. But you know what I'm asking?
It depends on the crew that you're getting. It's obviously person to person. It's like a personal attitude thing. Mm-hmm. We try not to, and I'm not just saying that to be PC. We really try not to. There's always a human being behind that. There's always a story. I'm not blaming somebody because their sugars are out of control and they don't know what to do and they don't know how to bolus. I'm not, you know, I would never judge them for being in that situation. I have pity on them. Most times it's pity more than anything else. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not talking about people who are abusive and call us every single day and just don't
to get test themselves their blood together.
To test their blood sugar, that's ridiculous. Right. It's just not nice. You're using public resources, like just right. You know, work that out. But generally, it's much more of a feeling of pity than anything else.
I don't get a crew of people coming through the door thinking, oh, this is diabetes. Here's another person that doesn't take care of themselves.
No.
I've
never seen that. Okay. I've never seen that in my 10 years. I haven't seen it. I'm not saying it doesn't happen again nationwide. I haven't seen that for the most part.
Okay. You know, I mean, I think most things go as people go. So if you get thoughtful, open-minded people, you get thoughtful, open-minded experiences.
Right.
Because sometimes I think about doctors, too. Like, you know, did that endocrinologist start off in the first couple of years just with a lot of enthusiasm, sitting down in every, you know, every meeting with every patient going, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to bolus. We're going to do this. We're going to get your settings right. And then one day it just was like, it just too many people didn't do it. And they just gave up. You know what I mean? Or lost their ability to be enthusiastic about something they thought wasn't going to go well. And how much of that? I mean, I think that's another thing that people should try to read through with their doctors. It's like, do I have a hopeful doctor, somebody who thinks we're going to get to a, you know, a great answer for me? Or am I sitting with somebody who's been beaten up by the world and doesn't?
Yeah, so yeah. I'll never forget, like, I had a doctor, you know, this was back in the UK. He was like 65, 350 pounds, and he's lecturing me about cholesterol or something. I'm like, are you serious? I think you got to change your doctors. I mean, I'm not, you know, sometimes it's harder when you're out of town and you're, you know, there isn't many options, especially within. But if you're living in any big city, chances are there's another endo down the road. I mean, just within the practice, there's normally other endos. I changed my son's endo. I remember from the first appointment, we were not happy. We were going to these appointments. She wasn't talking about diabetes or sugars or anything. It was always about something else and this vaccine and that vaccine. I'm not against vaccines, but she was like, every time, I'm like, is this a diabetes meeting or is this a vaccine meeting?
Yeah.
So like I actually changed to the head of the department. It was much better. And my personal doctor also, she used to be in one hospital. I went through 3-4 doctors till I found her, and then I moved over. She actually moved now to another hospital, so I moved over with her. She's amazing.
Yeah.
But like, don't sit on some, if your doctor's burnt out and not giving you what you need, don't sit on them.
Right.
Change them.
Yeah.
Now I know there's insurance issues and things like that, but you know, most times you can work that out.
I mean, sometimes you have to give more to get more, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, you get stuck with a bad doctor. It's easy to say, I don't have time to work this out, or I can't go find somebody else. But, I mean, you can't afford not to, honestly.
Yeah, I just heard this very interesting thing this week. It's called functional fixation. And it's essentially the way human beings just take things as they are. And, you know, they give a lot of examples for it. But one of the examples they gave is that freezers were always on top of fridges for the simple reason that it used to be an ice box on top, and the ice used to drip down into the freezer, into the fridge to keep things, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, once they came out with electronic freezers, nobody thought for years, like, hey, maybe we should flip it and put freezers at the bottom. They just kept it like that because that's how it's been. And that's how people are with a lot of things. They're just like, this is how it is. You know, this has been my doctor for 20 years. But like, if this is your doctor for 20 years and you're not getting what you need, nothing's going to, like, you got to change something.
Yeah.
If you're fixated on that, you're the one that's going to suffer at the end of the day.
Functional fixation is a cognitive bias that limits a person's ability to use an object in more ways than it's traditionally used, and it affects an individual's ability to innovate and be creative when solving challenges. How about that?
There you go.
Yeah, that's something. David, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this with me.
Sure.
No, I hope you had a good time.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. I can say my control is much better thanks to you. You'd be happy to know, even recently, I changed my high alert to 130. I'm not at 120 yet. We'll get there. Mm. But that's thanks to you and most of the things that I've learned on your podcast. So I really thank you for what you're doing. And you're reaching, you have no idea how many people you're reaching. I mean, I dealt with a new family that was just diagnosed a few weeks ago in another state. They knew right away about, as soon as I said something about the podcast, they'd already been told about it. They're already listening to it. You know, that's a far cry from when I was diagnosed.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I have to tell you, I've only been really stunned twice. Like the first time when somebody told me you're huge in the Mormon community, I was like, get out of here, really? And then this when I got the invite to come to the, you know, somebody said, you know,
right,
would you come and speak at our event? It's very private and everything. And I was like, sure, Mike, I don't understand. How do you know me? You know, because I actually, you know, before I got there, I very closely tied, you know, your religious beliefs with like no technology. And then I was like, how are they listening to the podcast even? But you guys are really great. Like it, you know, I don't know if I mentioned it here ever, but on the last day of the event, I was asked to come up and tell people what I learned while I was there. And I said, you know, despite the fact that you dress much differently than I'm accustomed to, and you know, your religious beliefs are, you know, different than I've heard, you guys are all exactly the same as every other person I've ever met in my entire life. And it really was my experience, you know?
Right. Yeah. There's definitely a lot of stereotypes. And like, for example, you mentioned about technology. I hear that the whole time. It's not true. It's completely not true.
Yeah.
There is an aversion to, you know, the healthiness of children having open internet access with no filters and, you know, sure, accessing things that completely inappropriate for their age. But the concept of technology, and especially when it comes to life-saving and health, you know, we don't use technology on the weekends generally as a community, as a religious community. That is not when it comes to health. You know, for example, Dexcoms and pumps and anything like that is excluded from that.
Sundown on Friday doesn't take away your Dexcom.
Correct.
Yeah.
100%.
Excellent.
And, you know, I have my phone with me on Saturday. My son has his phone. But yeah, when it comes to health. So yeah, there is a bit of a misnomer out there about that, but 100%.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously I said yes to coming back. I had a great time. So but you guys are very energetic. I felt like I didn't have a voice by the time I left, because that was the one downside, is that there's no microphone from.
Yeah.
And so you're projecting your voice, and you guys are so, I don't know if this is I actually found there was a shusher there. Like there was literally someone there. Like if the crowd got loud, that she'd step up and say, shh, everybody, she's talking. And I just realized it was kind of interesting, because at first it's off-putting because it's not something you're accustomed
to. You're not used to it.
Yeah. All but right. Then you see like I said something, it got people excited, and they kind of broke off into these little coffee clatches and started talking. And they were just really excited to talk about a new idea. I did okay. I thought the guy that I did it with, he did well, but he didn't have the personality to be loud for like 36 hours in a row. He looked a little beat up. I thought
you have a huge following.
Oh, it's so nice.
Yeah, I see it the whole time.
So nice. All right. Well, thanks so much. Let me say goodbye. I appreciate this.
All right.
Hold on one
second. Thank you so
much. Oh, my pleasure. A huge thanks to Touched by Type One for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast. Check them out on their website, touchedbytype1.org, or on Facebook and Instagram. Mark is an incredible example of what so many experience living with diabetes. You show up for yourself and others every day, never letting diabetes define you. And that is what the Medtronic Champion community is all about. Each of us is strong, and together, we're even stronger. To hear more stories from the Medtronic Champion community, or to share your own story, visit MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox. Don't forget, we still have Mark's conversation at the very end. It's a terrific kind of mini episode, about 10 minutes long, that goes deeper into some of the things that you heard Mark talking about earlier in the show. I want to thank the Eversense CGM for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast, and invite you to go to eversensecgm.com/juicebox to learn more about this terrific device. You can head over now and just absorb everything that the website has to offer, and that way you'll know if Eversense feels right for you. eversensecgm.com/juicebox. A diabetes diagnosis comes with a lot of new terms, and you're not going to understand most of them. That's why we made Defining Diabetes. Go to juiceboxpodcast.com, up into the menu, and click on Defining Diabetes to find the series that will tell you what all of those words mean. Short, fun, and informative, that's Defining Diabetes. If you're not already subscribed or following in your favorite audio app, please take the time now to do that. It really helps the show. And get those automatic downloads set up so you never miss an episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back very soon with another episode of the Juice Box Podcast. And now my full conversation with Medtronic champion, Mark. Mark, how old were you when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
I was 28.
28. How old are you now?
47.
So just about 20 years?
Yeah, 19 years.
What was your management style when you were diagnosed?
I used injections for about 6 months, and then my endocrinologist in the Navy recommended a pump.
How long had you been in the Navy?
8 years up to that point.
8 years.
Yeah.
I've interviewed a number of people who have been diagnosed during service, and most of the time they're discharged. What happened to you?
I was medically discharged. Yeah, 6 months after my diagnosis.
I don't understand the whole system. Is that like honorable?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, if you get a medical discharge, you get a commensurate honorable discharge. I guess there could be cases where something other than that, but that's really how it happens. So it's an honorable discharge but because of medical reasons.
And that still gives you access to the VA for the rest of your life, right?
Correct. Yeah, exactly.
Do you use the VA for your management?
Yeah, I used to up until a few years ago when we moved to North Carolina. It just became untenable. Mm-hmm. Just the rigmarole and process to kind of get all the things I needed, you know, for diabetes management. It was far easier just to go through a private practice.
Was it your goal to stay in the Navy for your whole life, your career?
It was. Yeah. In fact, I think a few months before my diagnosis, my wife and I had that discussion about, you know, staying in for the long term. And, you know, we'd made the decision despite all the hardships and time away from home. That was what we loved the most. So that's what made it that much more difficult.
Was the Navy a lifetime goal of yours, or something you came to as an adult?
Lifetime goal. I mean, as my earliest childhood memories were flying, being a fighter pilot, and specifically being flying on and off aircraft carriers. So, you know, watching Top Gun in the 80s certainly was a catalyst for that.
You've taken off and landed a jet on an aircraft carrier?
Hundreds of times.
Is there anything in life as exhilarating as that?
No, but there's a roller coaster I rode at, Cedar Rapids up in Cleveland, mm-hmm. Sandusky. And they've got this roller coaster that takes you from 0 to, I think it's like 80 or something. You go up a big hill and you come right back down. So the acceleration is pretty similar, I would say, to a catapult shot.
I'm going to guess you own a Tesla.
I don't. Okay. I'm a boring guy. I got a hybrid RAV4. I get made fun of. I get called, you know, my wife says I drive like a grandpa. I'm a 5 miles per hour over the speed limit person, no more than that. So yeah, in the car, I'm boring, Scott.
So you've never felt a need to try to replace that with something else?
You can't replace it. It's irreplaceable.
That's what I thought.
So up until the point where someone, you know, buys me an F-18 or allows me to get inside a 2-seater and fly it, you can't replace it.
How did it make you feel when you saw, or maybe you haven't seen, a gentleman named Pietro has his large aircraft license? He's flying for a major carrier now. He has type 1 diabetes. Does that feel hopeful to you?
Yeah, it does. You know, when I was diagnosed, that wasn't a possibility. The FAA prohibited commercial pilots who had type 1 diabetes. But I think it was 2017 when they changed their rules to allow type 1 diabetics to be commercial pilots. And part of the reason they did that was because of the technology advancements, specifically in pump therapy and pump management. So I don't have any aspirations of going to the commercial airlines, but one of my sons who has type 1 diabetes very much wants to be a commercial pilot. So, you know, in that respect, I'm very hopeful and thankful.
Yeah. Do you fly privately now for pleasure?
I do. Yeah. One of my favorite things to do is fly my kids to the different soccer tournaments I have all over the Southeast U.S. So last week, my wife and I and two of our boys flew up to Richmond for their soccer tournaments up there. And Charlie, who's my middle child, has type 1 diabetes. So, you know, if I can combine flying, family, and football in one weekend, to me, that's, I think I've just achieved Valhalla.
So then it sounds to me like this diagnosis was a significant course correction for you. Can you tell me how it affected your dream?
Well, I guess three words come to mind. First, it was devastating. Everything I had done in life, everything I'd worked up to that point was just taken away in an instant. And I was not prepared for that at all. The second emotion was it was scary. I hadn't thought much about life outside the Navy, certainly not life as anything else but a fighter pilot. And Heather and I were getting ready to move to France. I was going to do an exchange tour with the French Naval Air Force. So we were taking French classes. So pretty quickly, I had to reinvent myself. And then probably the most important thing at the same time that all that was going on, I had to learn how to deal with type 1 diabetes and how to manage it effectively. The third thing that pops into mind, I guess, is challenging. You know, new daily routines I had to establish, first with injections and then eventually, you know, through pump management. And then learning how to count carbs and recognize highs and lows, how my body reacts to blood sugar trends based on exercise and stress and those types of things. And my goal at that time, and it still is today, is to leverage technology and make sure my habit patterns are effective so that I take diabetes management from the forefront to the background.
Have you had success with that? Do you feel like you've made the transition well?
I have. I mean, I believe in continuous improvement, so there's always more to do. I will say the technology since I was diagnosed, specifically with pump management, is just, it's just incredible. It takes less of me intervening, and it's really done by the pump itself and by the algorithms through the CGMs. And to me, again, that should be the goal for everybody, is to not have to focus so much on the daily aspects of type 1 diabetes management. You know, we should let technology do that for us.
What else have you found valuable? I've spoken to thousands of people with type 1 diabetes. The one thing that took me by surprise, because I don't have type 1 myself and my daughter was very young when she was diagnosed, I didn't really understand until I launched this podcast and then it grew into this kind of big Facebook presence. I heard people say, I don't know anybody else who has type 1 diabetes. I wish I knew more people. But until I saw them come together, I didn't recognize how important it was.
Yeah, I think similarly, I didn't know anyone with type 1 diabetes growing up as an adult up until when I was diagnosed. And then all of a sudden, people just came out of the woodwork. And when CGMs first hit the market, certainly within the last 5 years, it's amazing to me and my family how many people we've noticed with type 1 diabetes simply because you can see the CGM on their arm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say a month does not go by where we don't run into someone at a restaurant or an amusement park or a sporting event or somewhere where we see somebody else with type 1 diabetes. And the other surprising aspect of that is just how quickly you make friends. And I'll give an example. We were at a soccer tournament up in Raleigh this past Saturday and Sunday, and the referee came over to my son Charlie at the end of the game and said, "Hey, I noticed you were wearing a pump." And he lifted up his shirt and showed his pump as well and said, "I've had type 1 diabetes since I was 9 years old. I played soccer in college. I'm sure that's your aspiration. And I just want to tell you, don't let type 1 diabetes ever stop you from achieving your dreams of what you want to do." And this gentleman was probably in his, you know, late 50s or 60s. So just having that connection and seeing, you know, the outreach and people's willingness to share their experiences, it just means the world to us and just makes us feel like we're part of a strong community.
Yeah. So would you say that the most important things are strong technology, tools, understanding how to manage yourself, and a connection to others?
Yeah, technology for sure, and knowing how to leverage it. And then the community, and that community is your friends, your family, caregivers, you know, for me, the Medtronic Champions community, you know, all those resources that are out there to, you know, help guide the way, but then help you keep abreast on, you know, the new things that are coming down the pipe.
Yeah.
And to give you hope for eventually, you know, that we can find a cure.
You mentioned that your son wanted to be a pilot. He also has type 1 diabetes. How old was he when he was diagnosed?
So Henry was diagnosed when he was 12 years old. It was just at the start of COVID. We were actually visiting my in-laws in Tennessee, we woke up in the morning and he had wet his bed. And several years before that, we had all four of our boys tested for TrialNet. So, you know, predictor of whether or not they're going to develop type 1 diabetes. And Heather or Henry and one of his brothers tested positive for a lot of the indicators. So we always kind of had an inclination that there was a high degree of possibility he would develop it. But we always had it at the back of our mind as well. And so when that event happened at the beginning of COVID, we had him take his blood sugar on my glucometer and it was over 400. And so right away, we knew that without even being diagnosed properly by endocrinologists that he was a type 1 diabetic. So we hurried home to get him properly diagnosed in Charlottesville. And then we just started the process, first grieving, but then acceptance and, you know, his eventual becoming part of the team that nobody wants to join.
How old is he now?
Yeah, he's 15 years old now.
When's the first time he came to you and said, is this going to stop me from flying?
Almost immediately. So like me, he always had aspirations of flying. In fact, he, out of all four boys, wanted to be in the military. And that was a difficult part of the conversation and maybe something that we don't talk about as a community. But there are some things you cannot do as a type 1 diabetic. And that's a hard fact of life. And unfortunately, joining the military is one of those hard and fast things. You cannot be, you cannot join the military as a type 1 diabetic. So that was very difficult for him and for me and my wife to get over. Then we also started talking about being a commercial pilot. So I saw that same excitement in his eyes because like me, you know, he can be in an F-18 or a 737 or a Cirrus SR-20 that I fly and be just as happy. Yeah. So he still has that passion today and still very much plans to eventually become a commercial pilot.
I appreciate you sharing that with me. Thank you. You have four children. Do any others have type 1?
They do. My oldest twin, Henry, has type 1 diabetes, and my middle son, Charlie, has type 1 diabetes as well.
The boys are twins.
The oldest two are twins. One has type 1 diabetes. My middle son, who is not a twin, has type 1 diabetes.
I see. Is there any other autoimmune in your family?
There isn't. I'm really the only person in my family or my wife's family that we know of with any sort of autoimmune disease, certainly type 1 diabetes. So unfortunately, I was the first to strike it rich and unfortunately pass it along to two of my sons.
But celiac, thyroid, anything like that?
Nothing. We're really a pretty healthy family. So this came out of nowhere for myself and for my two sons.
That's really something. I appreciate your time very much. And I appreciate you sharing this with me. Thank you very much.
Anytime, Scott.
Learn more about the Medtronic Champion community at MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox or by searching the hashtag Medtronic Champion on your favorite social media platform. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording. WrongWayRecording.com.